Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Dean Strang. He's best known these days as one of the two defense attorneys for accused murderer Stephen Avery, a case made internationally famous through the hit Netflix documentary series Making a Murderer. Dean is a criminal defense attorney with the firm Strang Bradley and has taught law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Note that my conversation with Dean will extend to next week. This week we'll discuss issues more directly related to the Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey cases. And next week, we'll discuss representation for the indigent and a book that Dean wrote about an entirely different case titled Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. Dean, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Grant.
Let me start with a simple but perhaps maybe the most difficult question. Can you give our listeners a brief summary of the Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey cases, your involvement in the cases, and then bring us up to date from where the series left off?
Stephen Avery was released in September 2003 after 18 years in prison on a rape that he had not committed, was exonerated by DNA. A little over 2 years after he was released from that wrongful conviction, Teresa Halbach, a 25-year-old photographer, freelance photographer, disappeared at some point after an appointment with Stephen Avery to photograph a car that his sister was selling. In the ensuing week, it was a missing persons investigation. Her remains eventually were found near Stephen Avery's trailer on the Avery Auto Salvage property, and he was charged with first-degree intentional homicide, Wisconsin's version of first-degree murder. About 4 months later, his then 16-year-old nephew, Brendan Dassey, was charged with the same crime as an accomplice, essentially. And the men were tried separately. Both were convicted. The direct appeals, that is, the appeals through the Wisconsin state court system, failed for both men.
And you were part of those?
I was not.
Oh, you were not part of those.
I represented Stephen Avery through his sentencing.
Okay.
And then turned it over to appellate counsel, which for local reasons is what you typically do in Wisconsin with a case that's gone to trial. And the direct appeals for both men failed. The convictions were affirmed. Brendan Dassey very recently has gotten relief on a writ of habeas corpus in federal court. The state now is considering its option to appeal to the Federal Court of Appeals. But as it stands, Brendan Dassey would be entitled to release or a new trial if the state does not appeal that decision successfully. Stephen Avery did not get habeas relief and is pursuing now, through the efforts of a new legal team, new evidence that might warrant a motion for a new trial.
Okay, thanks. Now, the series reveals and suggests that some pretty disturbing things about our criminal justice system, and I think that's what's gotten people, you know, particularly interested in it and agitated about it. As someone who works in this field and has seen, I imagine, other disturbing things in other cases, what bothered you the most about the way this particular case was investigated and prosecuted?
The sheriff's department that ordinarily would have had jurisdiction over this crime just by virtue of where the body was found was being sued by Stephen Avery at the time for its role in his earlier wrongful conviction. That federal civil rights lawsuit was coming to a head, and a number of members of the department had been deposed, had had their depositions taken in that civil case. So when the new missing person and then homicide investigation arose, that sheriff's department told the public that it was stepping away from and would not participate substantively in the investigation of the new crimes concerning the death of Teresa Halbach. The public was told that the investigation would be handled by the sheriff's department from the adjoining county to the west. And the public was told this a number of times by both law enforcement agencies, both of the sheriff's departments. That turned out not to be true. And indeed, most of the significant physical evidence, almost all of it, was in fact recovered by members of the sheriff's department that said it would not be participating substantively in the investigation. That, I think, is at the root of a lot of my concerns about the reliability of the investigation and ultimately of the convictions.
Now, you have said you're pretty sure that, and it follows on to, I guess, where this concern of yours goes, that their behavior was suspect in some of this evidence gathering. Can you say a little bit about that?
I think the most reasonable inference is that at least some evidence here, and I would put a car key that worked with Ms. Halbach's Toyota at the top of my list, that the most reasonable inference is that that key was put where it was found by law enforcement, not by Mr. Avery or whoever committed the crime. It's not the only possible inference, but to me, there is a strong inference there and reasonably strong inferences as to some other evidence that the case may have been augmented dishonestly by those investigating it or possibly by, you know, somebody involved in the crime itself.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Dean Strang, former defense attorney for Stephen Avery, a case profiled in the Netflix series Making a Murderer. Let me shift to the other person in this case, Brendan Dassey. Watching this series, the fact that his supposed confession was allowed to be admitted as evidence gave me one of those rare moments when I'm yelling at the television. Help me wrap my mind around that decision.
Well, I don't know that I can help you in the end. Much of Stephen Avery's circumstances were unusual to the point of being unique. You know, an exoneree who then later gets charged with a new homicide and happens to be suing the sheriff's department at the time. Really almost a one-off. But Brendan Dassey's experience, the experience of the 16-year-old nephew, unfortunately nothing all that unusual, let alone unique, about it. The interview that you saw of him in custody of the police displayed the interview or interrogation techniques routinely used by law enforcement in this country today and for the last 60 years or more. A 16-year-old or a young person being in police custody, away from family, without, you know, an advocate or lawyer, very common, happens every day in this country. Most people charged with crimes are 25 or under in the United States. And somebody with obvious learning disabilities, learning delays, also very common in our criminal justice system. So the matching against well-trained, if you will, police officers or at least experienced police officers using highly manipulative interview techniques that they get taught starting with academy and applying those to someone who's at a mental, emotional, and experiential disadvantage is very, very commonplace.
So if that was my most frustrating moment watching this series, what was your single most frustrating moment trying the case?
For me, it was the judge's decision right before trial to allow the prosecution to do mid-trial testing through the FBI of a blood vial that plays an important role in the case and some blood swabs or swabs of blood obtained from Ms. Halbach's car, knowing that those results and an FBI analyst testimony would arrive mid-trial and that the defense would have no opportunity at all then to conduct independent testing.
And it's certainly, I think, fair to say that this film has helped Stephen Avery's case now that it's come out and it's gotten so much attention. I was wondering how the filming affected your work as an attorney working on this case.
How the filming affected my work then?
How did that go? Did it get in the way? Were there complications?
I would not say that it got in the way. I would say that I was never at ease when being filmed outside the courtroom. In the courtroom, the filming was all but invisible to us, just because the courtroom was a modern courtroom set up for media access. So there were ceiling-mounted cameras that were operated remotely, no bigger than security cameras. The media were in a booth behind the gallery of the courtroom. So you weren't hearing shutters clicking. You know, there weren't cables duct taped to the floor. There wasn't a visible media presence, if you will, in the courtroom. So, you know, in the moment of trying a case, it was very easy to be essentially unaware that you were being filmed. But outside the courtroom, I was very much aware of the presence of cameras, and I'm not a natural on camera.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Dean Strang. He's a criminal defense attorney based in Madison, Wisconsin, and was one of Stephen Avery's attorneys in a case profiled in the Netflix series Making a Murderer. Well, there's a different lawyer handling Stephen Avery's current appeals now, which have been in the news. Why did you step off the case? Explain that process to me and why you're not involved.
It's peculiar to Wisconsin appellate practice. In my state and probably in others, but certainly in Wisconsin, if ineffective assistance of counsel, I mean, in layman's terms, if an argument that the defense lawyers in a criminal case blew it, performed inadequately, if that argument's going to be made on appeal in Wisconsin, it's got to be made in the first appeal, or what's called the direct appeal. So in a case that's been tried, and even some that haven't been tried, it's better practice in Wisconsin for trial counsel to get out when the appellate process begins so that fresh eyes can look at whether the trial lawyers rendered ineffective assistance of counsel, violated the Sixth Amendment of the accused in that way. So, you know, as a matter of routine, especially in cases that have been tried in Wisconsin, you'll typically see a changeover of counsel after sentencing. And that's exactly what happened here. Jerry and I withdrew in favor of appellate counsel from the appellate division of our state public defender, which is a very fine appellate group.
So it wasn't like the two of you just said, we can't take this anymore, we're done.
No, I think we were about emotionally done, but that was not the reason. I mean, the reason was it's just the right thing to do because – you know, you don't raise ineffective assistance against yourself. Your own interests would be at stake there. Moreover, if you made a serious mistake, the reason you probably made it is you didn't realize you were making it, and you're no more likely to realize it when you look at the record on appeal than you did the first time at trial. So, you know, you turn it over to fresh appellate counsel who then can look objectively at all the issues, including defense counsel's performance.
Now, you said before that the filming, you weren't comfortable with that outside of the courtroom where it was kind of more obvious what was going on. But the series has nonetheless made you a star of sorts. I mean, a public celebrity. So you had something there that you communicated to other people. How has that experience then and the aftermath of the film changed your ability to represent clients? I'm sure it's generated some business on the one hand, but has it made what happens in court more complicated for you?
Well, it's actually generated very little business. That's not what publicity does for at least criminal defense lawyers. What it has generated, in addition to a lot of very nice emails, letters, you know, very, very flattering contact with strangers. You know, but more work-related, what it has produced is lots and lots of letters from prison, from prisoners or their family members. Often people who've been in prison for a long time have exhausted their ordinary appellate opportunities and, you know, are really looking for, you know, somebody who might give them hope. And that's what publicity typically does in criminal defense. Now, don't get me wrong. In the long term, it really may produce a good case or two or a good referral. Most of my work comes from other lawyers, and they, you know, they aren't likely to be driven by this docuseries. They're much more likely to be reacting to the fact they know me or know me by reputation. But, it, you know, over the long run, it may produce a case or two.
If you just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the criminal defense attorney, Dean Strang. I've got a couple more sensitive questions for you now. Stephen Avery was convicted. He's still in jail. Do you feel like you let him down in some way?
Yes, I do. You're asking me how I feel, and I'm responding, you know, with your verb. But, you know, Stephen settled his civil lawsuit for pennies on what he might have otherwise obtained had he not been charged with this new crime, settled it for the purpose of retaining counsel. And he took all those chips and he put them on me and Jerry Buting, me, and then 2 weeks later, Jerry joined in. And you feel a sense of responsibility for any client who could have picked 1,000 other lawyers and came to you, and I lost his case. That sense of responsibility, whether it should or shouldn't be rationally, is in fact magnified when the consequences are awful for the client. And here they were as bad as it gets under Wisconsin law. Stephen got life without the possibility of parole. It's a case I think objectively should have been won. You know, you don't argue a case typically on reasonable doubt grounds, but in the end, I think, to my eye at least, there was reasonable doubt about Stephen's guilt, and we didn't win it. So that's something that I should carry and do carry and will carry.
You probably don't want to answer this next question, but I have to ask it to you. Who do you think killed Teresa Halbach?
You know, I don't know is the short and honest answer. If were I to elaborate, I would say I have my own ideas about who should have been investigated more closely and who would be worthy of investigation now. During the trial or pretrial process, Jerry and I put together something like a 40-page brief laying out the case against a number of people. The judge excluded that evidence, and the Wisconsin Court of Appeals upheld his decision to exclude our effort to offer an alternate perpetrator. So I'm not now about to go on a radio program and accuse somebody of murder publicly. I think that you know, that argument belonged in the confines of trial advocacy, and I lost that. But I do think that the investigative focus centered awfully early, in fact, almost immediately, on Stephen Avery to the exclusion of, you know, people who would have and should have been within the field of persons of interest, as law enforcement like to say.
The current attorney for him, if I understand correctly, has suggested that the test that she wants to have done and where she's going to go with this is going to show that alternative perpetrator. Is that correct?
I understand her motion to be seeking additional testing primarily to clear Stephen Avery and secondarily, with the hope of identifying the actual culprit. But I think, if I understand her efforts to date correctly, the primary focus remains on clearing Mr. Avery. You know, in the end, defense lawyers don't have police departments, don't have, you know, the ability to go to a judge and get a search warrant, and don't have the resources of the government behind them. And it would be nice if a defense lawyer could solve a crime, but our portfolio, if you will, is to try to make sure that it, the state at least doesn't get the wrong guy. And others often have to worry about who the right guy is.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you thought he should have been cleared based on the representation and the arguments that you made, the evidence that you presented. Did you think, though, that you were going to win? I mean, you know you've got the public, I think, at that time was not very predisposed to think he was innocent. Did you think you were going to win?
The answer to that, Grant, is no, but it needs an asterisk or some explanation. I find guilty verdicts, even when I, you know, when objectively I think they're justified, I find them so hard to take personally, where I, you know, I've invested myself in the case and tried it, generally come to know and like my client well, that what I do as purely as a defense mechanism is I always assume I'm going to lose. I tell myself after closing arguments that I'm going to lose. I start preparing post-trial motions that I won't need if, in fact, I win, because I need to steel myself for a guilty verdict if it comes. And if I'm surprised with a not guilty verdict, that's a lot easier to take than a guilty verdict that surprises me. Jerry, I think, Buting, my co-counsel in this case, is much braver in some ways. And I think he did expect that this case would result in a not guilty verdict. We both, in the end, were, you know, just very deeply disappointed in the verdict that came.
That was Dean Strang. Again, our conversation will continue next week when we discuss criminal defense for the poor and Dean's book on a century-old case in Milwaukee involving Clarence Darrow. Dean, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.